Session number 3167.
So Aubrey Elwood, Reel 5. Can I ask you how you came to be involved in the aftermath of the Quetta earthquake in 1935 and what your impressions of Quetta were after the earthquake?
Yes, well, I was hardly involved in it, but as I told you, I was on the staff at headquarters, which was then at Simla during the summer months, and I was sent by the commander-in-chief to go to Quetta to see whether there was anything particular they wanted, and just to find out what the situation was, which I did, and I flew up there, of course, and was able, I think, to give them a little help in various little ways. I really can't remember what they were, but they, if they wanted to do something without having to send a lot of signals or write a lot of letters, they asked me whether I thought it was all right, and I would say yes or no according to what it was, but mostly yes, because it was all common sense stuff which obviously had to be done, and it would be much better to give a definite answer straight away and have no more nonsense over it. That's really what it amounted to. I was only there for a day or a couple of days or something of that sort, and you asked me what impression I had. Well, the place was in parts almost unrecognisable, because although I knew it backwards, I'd been there for 3 years before, stationed there, and it was all looking quite different because a great many of the landmarks were just flat. And I didn't realise, driving about, how much I used to depend upon certain landmarks to know where to turn for a certain part of the cantonment. It was quite a big place, Quetta, and I remember driving up to the staff college, which was quite a few miles away, 2 or 3 miles up the road, I couldn't find my way once or twice. It didn't last long, but I had to think about it instead of just driving naturally along. That's the sort of thing. And of course, the bazaar was, and what I saw of it was only the edge, was an awful mess and everything. And of course, our own lines, the Air Force lines, were very badly knocked about indeed.
Were they still trying to cope with the wounded, the injured, when you got there?
Yes, I think they'd got them out, as far as I remember. Yes, I'm sure they had. They'd got over that first immediate stage, but the wing commander, who is Sir John Slessor, he was there as the wing commander in charge. He was wearing a bandage round his head because he and had his bungalow very badly damaged and got knocked about. So that's the sort of state I found them in. They were all in very good heart and were getting on with the job. But they were having difficulties, of course. And they did lose. He'll tell you all the details about the casualties, and I think it's largely in his book anyway.
In 1936, you returned to England from India, and the following year you went to the Imperial Defence College for the course there.
Yeah.
What did the course there consist of, and what value did you feel that it had?
Well, it was a most valuable course. It introduced one to all sorts of things one hadn't come across before. All apart from doing exercises with they were all combined exercises, pretty well. It was the lectures were of great interest because they came from all sorts of departments that one didn't hear of very much. A lot of political stuff one got, for instance, which one didn't get in the normal course of events very much. And we were, as you probably know, the Imperial Defence College had students from all services, and from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, representatives of the Commonwealth. And one got to know a great many people in that way, and visiting lecturers and so on, from all services. It was very much of a combined show, and it taught one a lot about what the services did for each other, and from our point of view, what emphasized what we thought we could do for them. We were always in a rather, I always thought, in a rather different position in a way from the other two, because we had a great deal of our work was definitely in aid of naval or military operations, whereas their work was far more their own, and we were something they could use, if you see what I mean. That was quite apart from our own ideas on a role as a strategic force for independent operations, such as the bombing. And then, of course, there was all the support of the sea operations, maritime operations, which was another thing, quite different from things we had to do. Army cooperation, naval cooperation in the ordinary sense of the word. And we didn't, of course, we hadn't developed it all in practice. We had our ideas on what we could do, and very, very firm ideas, and what we ought to be doing in a future war. But we hadn't had time, had the opportunity, really, to put them into practice. And of course, when the war came, we learned a great many lessons from practical experience which we'd never had a chance to learn before. But on, by and large, we weren't far out about our idea.
In 1937, did you find that representatives of the other services underestimated or overestimated or both what air power could actually achieve?
I think on the whole I would say underestimated. From the point of view, at any rate, of independent operations, they didn't really understand what we were trying to aim at, and hadn't real confidence in the fact that it would be of real value. It was not surprising, because nobody had ever seen it working, you see. Even we hadn't, but not on a big scale. And I could understand that. At the IDC, they were all most cooperative and friendly, and we would argue out our case. And, for instance, in a combined, what we called syndicates, which most of the exercises were done in syndicates, composed of all the people representing the various departments they came from. Incidentally, we had some civil servants and some colonial people, that sort of thing, as well. And I would say that they did underestimate, but I think sometimes they overestimated what we could do for them. Sometimes they might say, well, you say we can do so-and-so, and ask for something rather impractical, because they didn't really understand what the limitations were, you see, which all, again, was perfectly natural. But
did that apply more to the Army or to the Navy, or did that apply to both of them?
I should say to both of them. One, of course, the Navy didn't believe that a capital ship could be sunk by a torpedo aircraft. They had to learn that by hard experience during the war. That's the sort of thing. Whereas we we're quite sure that in the future, at any rate, we should, even if the torpedo as it existed at that time might not have been very effective. But honestly, I don't know what happened, because we never had a chance to sink them, really.
In these syndicates, the exercises that you did, were you in fact studying realistic situations? In which the countries were actually named, situations in which Germany was the enemy and so on, or were they all rather more theoretical in the way they were defined?
No, I mean, there were various types of exercise, you see. Some might be a definite operational exercise, which would have to have an enemy, naturally, and it might be anybody, Germany or Russia or Japan or anywhere else, you see. And other exercises were more on the organizational administrative basis, on a very high level, as you say, not going into detail, but generally making some sort of giving some sort of answer to a problem which was not in the middle of a war. And it didn't have to be in the middle of a war, but it was getting probably a planning operation or broad planning before a war and that sort of thing. It's awfully difficult to describe, especially at this distance. I can't remember what they all were. But there were, I know I was engaged in some very interesting exercises of that sort. And we had our little arguments amongst ourselves. But I've often said that if you put, I don't know whether I said it to you before or not, I've often said that if you put, you had an operation, in actual war, this was, to carry out, and you put a sailor and a soldier and an airman all together and said, now, this is what we've got to do, you get on with it as best you can, we would make probably a very reasonable plan, in fact, certainly, as long as we didn't get too much interference from above. Leave them, if we were allowed to put those three together, because it never really quite happened like that, because it was probably three services, the Admiralty and the War Office and the Air Ministry, if it might be, you see, which was far more difficult to manage. But three individuals would use their common sense and make a good plan. This is only my own theory. But the fact was that no service really knew quite enough about the other two in those days. They know far more about each other now than they did before. And in those days, they didn't know so much. You had to do a lot of explaining your point of view, and they did to us, and so on, and so on. And it took a little time. Well, if you've got three people round a table, or even half a dozen representatives, it's a small meeting, and you will realize that you can come to a decision and make the best plan you can, bringing everything to account.
In general, in your contacts with the other services, particularly the Army in the interwar period, did you feel at all that the RAF was the more professional, most professional of the services, and the most realistic in its anticipations with regard to a future war?
Well, in some ways, I think we did, because, you see, we had ideas about the use of air, which was new to everybody else, and we were the people who'd studied it, and I suppose we knew more about it. And we felt sometimes that it was rather difficult to get them to understand or to accept, really, what we were recommending, because they hadn't had the experience of it, and they hadn't got so much confidence as we should have liked in it. And we sometimes thought that they were apt to be a little old-fashioned, you see. Well, it's putting it rather bluntly and rather perhaps too few words, because it isn't. It would take a long time to explain the differences. But there were differences between us, and I think they were perfectly normal, natural ones. We used to get a bit irritated with each other from time to time, but not in an offensive way at all. But we might. It was an excellent opportunity there. We were all on a very friendly level, and we could all say exactly what we meant without giving offence. And it was a very useful course in that way, and it did bring out, I think, anybody who'd been to the IDC and done a course and remembered it, and the sort of discussions they'd had with the sailors and the soldiers, would be really better equipped for dealing with the little differences of opinion, etc., between when the war came.
At the end of 1937, you moved on from the IDC to join the directing staff at the Staff College.
Yeah.
What did your duties involve as a member?
Well, I was teaching other people to be staff officers. And, as far as one could, commanders too, because some of the exercises they would be It was one of our objects to equip them to take command as well as to be staff officers, if you see what I mean. But a lot of that was, you could call it, I suppose, academic stuff. I mean, you had to teach them how to write a military appreciation, for example, how to write clear orders. And there's quite a lot in that. I can't give you a lecture on writing appreciations, which you've no doubt read yourself anyway, but it was a very important, and I personally think the most practical and the best and most logical way of thinking out a problem. So it was very important that staff officers should be taught to do all their work in that particular way, because you knew then that it would have been, if a man was a good staff officer, he would argue out a case on logical lines. You needn't necessarily agree with him when he came to his conclusion, but it would all be there for you, see. Very important. It was one of the principal things to teach people how, and incidentally, teach them how to write English. Teach them how to use their language effectively without too many words and so on.
In your period as a student at the Staff College, you'd actually, one of your specialisations you told me about last time had been international law. What kind of specialisations did you have to do as a member of the directing staff?
Oh, anything that came your way. When you talk about me as a student, having that as a specialisation, that's hardly true. It was only that I happened to be rather interested in it, and I thought it would be an interesting subject as a subject for my lecture, which we all had to give. I was never a technician, never been a technician in my life, so I chose something on the broader line of that sort, and I thought it was more interesting. I found it very interesting. But if I hadn't chosen that, I guess I wouldn't have known anything about international law at all.
Were you able to follow that up when you joined the directing staff at all?
No, because not really. I dare say it came in handy every now and then, having it in the back of my mind, but there were certain things. We'd study certain campaigns in the past, compare campaigns in the First War, for example. I actually took over a series of lectures on Mesopotamia, where I'd never been, but I used the previous lectures and read a lot, of course, and took that one. And there were one or two other things I took on that. I really can't remember what they were. And we all, of course, had to comment on students' work on all sorts of subjects. So we had to make ourselves conversant with whatever exercise was being done at the time, because we had to take our own syndicate. Again, we worked in syndicates, and we used to take them, our own divisions, as it were, from amongst the students, you see, a certain number, who one would be a sort of tutor to them the whole time. And we would make our corrections on, our comments, reading comments. And we had to know something about all the subjects. Well, that meant quite a lot of study, of course, because we couldn't know everything. But if you were going to try and teach somebody else, you've got to get yourself up to a reasonable standard of knowledge and of the particular thing you were trying to put over.
Did students there during your time ever come up with better solutions than the directing staff solution in their syndicates?
Well, no, I don't know whether they did. You see, all that I should have said to you too, that a new exercise or a revised exercise would be discussed amongst the directing staff with all the knowledge they had, you see, to get, and we'd argue out what the best way of putting it was and so on. And somebody in the directing staff who was responsible for that exercise, for example, supposing it was the writing of an appreciation, a big appreciation, he would produce the answer. Well, that would be discussed very thoroughly indeed, and amended according to the views of the directing staff, so that we were all agreed, we knew what the line of thought was, and if we hadn't agreed around the conference table, as it were, we would have been in a less advantageous position from the point of view of commenting on anybody else's solution. No, I would say that sometimes it would be possible for somebody who was particularly up to date in one particular line, he'd just come from one command which was doing something or other, whatever it was, he might know a little bit more than some of us did. On the other hand, the directing staff were chosen from people who had a reasonably wide experience, and some would perhaps would definitely have had special knowledge about some particular aspect of our operations and so on.
This was a time of very rapid changes in the Air Force. Did you feel that leading on from what you're just saying, that the people at the staff, that the staff college was in any sense something of an ivory tower that people could get out of touch if they stayed too long at the staff college?
No, we never really did stay too long at the staff college. I think the standard time for a member of the directing staff was 3 years, as far as I remember, something like that. Well, actually, I didn't do 3 years at a stretch because the war intervened, you see, after I'd been there for about 18 months. Then I went on to more staff college work after, but that was rather different. But it's... No, I don't think one got out of touch. One kept in touch, of course, very much. If you were doing an exercise, for example, on some subject that you hadn't much immediate knowledge of, you'd go up to the Admiralty or to the command concerned or something and find out what was going on, you see. So we didn't allow ourselves to get out of touch. We couldn't, of course. No, I wouldn't say that. I think we can claim that we didn't allow ourselves to get out to be. What did you describe? What did you call it?
I wondered whether it was an ivory tower.
An ivory tower? No. I don't think I ever heard it described as such.
Can you remember any visits that you made during your time there, either up to the ministries in London or to operational command headquarters?
Oh, well, it's difficult to remember. Well, my one was... we would do, for example, perhaps a visit, all of us, to an fighter operations room, something of that sort, which we personally perhaps had never seen ourselves, but we then knew how it worked and so on, and the students went too, the whole party went. And if you were in any particular difficulty over something you were doing, you could at any moment make an arrangement, if you wanted to go and ask the expert. And of course, they used to come down and lecture to us as well from the various commands, so we knew what they were up to, as far as it was possible to know.
Was the atmosphere and life in general at the Staff College affected as war became increasingly imminent through 1938 and into 1939 when you were there?
Well, of course, people were beginning to get a bit excited about it. They realised that war was pretty well bound to come and so forth, and of course, I suppose it might have had the effect of making people all the keener to learn how to behave themselves when they got out into a real operations or real staff work. But as far as the atmosphere of the place was concerned, it was very much the same one way or the other.
What happened to you when war actually broke out in 1939? Were you still at the staff college?
I was left at the staff college with the idea of starting some war courses. And That was my war appointment. And I did actually start and take charge of the first war course in quite, only 2 months or so after the war started, I suppose. And people were sent to do a course. People of all sorts and descriptions, mostly from civil life, not our own people. There were a few, of course, of our own, of our regulars and people, but a lot of them were completely new. And it was a very interesting job, as a matter of fact, because we found that our way of tackling a big problem was really quite different from people who came straight out of civil life. We had to teach them how to do it. But many of them were extremely quick at taking up the thing, and they saw the point, and they did very well indeed, and they became very useful, excellent staff officers. Not all of them, but quite a number did.